This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds, like the breathable, silky smooth Tree Dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Runner, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Shay.
We've had some fun on the show recently. We've had some lighthearted episodes, ones that aren't very serious. And today we're going to be doing a pretty heavy episode.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to be going into the more grim, bleak side of humanity. But I think it's important. As sort of a listener discretion disclaimer, I just wanted to say that the following episode contains detailed accounts of brutal and violent crimes. Topics will include rape, sexual assault, and the mutilation of a corpse. I just wanted to give our listeners a fair warning that we are going to be covering some pretty dark and awful stuff today, but I've done my best to not glorify these acts or use them as cheap parlor tricks or shock moments. All of these things I'm about to cover and explain to you pertain directly to understanding our case today, and I'll try to be as gentle and respectful to the victims as possible. Well, Aaron, are you ready for episode 37?
I'm ready. I can't say that I'm super excited about it, but I know it's a very important case, so.
Yeah, it's got a lot of implications, and, you know, you'll see as we get into it, something that we've known we have to cover at some point, but we really kind of haven't been looking forward to covering it.
Yeah.
Well, this is episode 37, Terror in Amarillo, Texas, and sources for today. The first one comes to us from historicalcrimedetective.com. Now, this is an interesting website that is run by a true crime writer, Jason Morrow, and he does something called Mugshot Mondays, which is a segment that he puts out from time to time about interesting crimes that have been forgotten in the annals of history. And he did a really neat write-up about this case. I would also plug his book, which looks really good, and it's free on Kindle Unlimited, and it's called Famous Crimes, The World Forgot, Volume 2. I used a series of articles from the New York Times archives, which I kind of plugged my last episode. It's a really great source for old newspaper archives, and these articles were written by Carl Robertson back in 1986. I also use the United Press International, or UPI. Several articles were really important that were written by Mary Slangenstein back in 1985. I also used a source called law.justia.com, and this was for all of my appeals information, which there were several sets of appeals documents. Those were published back in the mid-1980s. The Associated Press was a great source, and those come to us from Michael Grazik in 1985. And I also used some local newspapers, Amarillo.com, and a couple of defunct newspapers, the Amarillo Daily News and the Amarillo Watchman. And those articles were by John Ballou, Pete Borgensen, and Sarah Strand. Those were all from back in the 1980s. I also used a book called Amarillo, The Story of a Western Town by Paul H. Carlson, published in 2006. That's an interesting source, and I think it's one of the first, like, non-true crime sources I've ever used. And it's a really interesting look at the history of Amarillo, Texas. And there's a whole section, a whole chapter about this period of time in his book. And he did an amazing job of capturing the environment, the atmosphere, the tension of the society that was going on at the time. It's a really good read. He's a good writer. And lastly, I used an article from Psychology Today written by PhD Barrett Brogard. And that was published May of this year. All right, Aaron. We like to cover our cities in Texas at least once when we first do a case there. So we haven't ever done Amarillo before.
I know, first time.
Yep. And as you can probably tell from my sources, this week's case is in fact from Amarillo, and it's during the end of the 1970s into the early 1980s. Amarillo is situated right in the middle of the Texas Panhandle. It was founded back in 1877 when a handful of successful ranch owners in the area banded together to build a town. Amarillo grew in the following decades to become the central hub of the vast North Texas grasslands, and it also became the largest city in the region. This is an area commonly known as the High Plains of Texas, because it's literally a vast, flat, high plain of grass. Within these huge grasslands and at the boundaries of the High Plains of Texas, you will also find cap rock mesas, playa lakes, canyon lands, and large river valleys such as the Canadian River. We got to visit the Canadian River once when we went up to the Panhandle and did some archaeology. You remember that?
Yeah, I do. I think that's the only time I've been around Amarillo, was just kind of driving through it to get up to the north part of the Panhandle.
Fun fact for those of you still questioning just how big Texas really is. Amarillo actually sits closer in proximity to the capitals of Oklahoma, New Mexico, and even Colorado than it does to its own capital of Austin, Texas, far to the south.
Yep, I believe that.
Well, back in the 1980s, Amarillo had a population around 150,000 people. Today, though, the Amarillo metropolitan area has an estimated population of about 275,000 people. This makes it the 14th largest city in Texas. So it's kind of like one of those larger Texas cities that is typically forgotten amongst Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, and so on. The city and its surrounding counties have a long history in agriculture and cattle production. But in the last 40 years, they've experienced their own oil boom and gas booms. Today, Amarillo is known for leading Texas, as well as the U.S., in helium gas production, meat processing and packing, aircraft assembly, and it's the only nuclear weapons assembly and disassembly facility in the country.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Weird.
All of our nuclear weapons are either put together or dismantled in Amarillo, Texas.
I did not know that.
Kind of scary,
huh? Brand new information.
So how about that name Amarillo? You know where it comes from, Aaron?
Kind of sounds like armadillo.
Well, you speak a little Spanish, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not really.
You remember your basic colors?
Yeah.
Amarillo is Spanish for yellow.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And thus, that's where it gets one of its several nicknames, the Yellow Rose of Texas. So I thought that was kind of interesting. We have a yellow rose on our logo, and we're talking about the Yellow Rose of Texas City today.
Hmm.
Other city nicknames include the Helium Capital of the World, which is self-proclaimed, Rotor City, USA, because they build a lot of aircraft there, and of course, Bomb City, because that's where they make bombs.
Okay.
The end of the 1970s and the early 1980s were a chaotic and controversial time for Amarillo. In his book, Amarillo, The Story of a Western Town, Paul H. Carlson describes this period as full of corruption, racial tensions, riots, police scandals, and political upheaval, all of which, true or not, were considered as symptoms that reached all the way up to the top of City Hall. The then mayor of Amarillo, Jerry H. Hodge, became a prime target for all of these concerns and accusations. Briefly, I kind of want to touch on the way that the Amarillo Police Department were being viewed during this time, because it's going to become very important with regards to today's case. So on December of 1979, in the heart of Amarillo's African-American community, a fatal car accident occurred. Reports from witnesses at the scene claim the investigation of the accident and the attempted rescue were completely botched by predominantly white police officers that reported to the scene. Some of the claims were that the white officers were seemingly uncaring about the African-American citizens that were literally dying in this car, and they weren't working hard enough to get them out. Also, the other person involved in the accident was a white motorist, and witnesses say he was completely to blame for the accident, but police just took his statement and let him go. Reports of resulting civil suits by organized African-American groups in the north of Amarillo started to surface in the local media, and ensuing race riots began flaring up in and around the city. These events eventually culminated in a civil rights march that descended on City Hall to demand the removal of then-police chief Lee Spradlin. Though the movement received ample media attention, Mayor Hodge publicly backed the Amarillo Police Department and Chief Lee Spradlin. So I think you can see at this point, Amarillo was at a heightened atmosphere of tension, anger, and fear that they had never really experienced before.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of disillusionment with the people in power and the police.
We've seen, you know, today we have some of those same problems happening around the U.S. and major cities. So yeah. Complaints and claims of inadequate police work, corruption, and outright negligence had begun to mount months earlier. And that's because Amarillo had just experienced one of the most grisly murders in its entire history. And the killer was still on the loose. That's right. I'm talking about the infamous Amarillo Slasher, a.k.a. the Texas Bowie Knife Killer. So a few months earlier, on the evening of October 26th, 1979, tragedy struck. That night, David Lawrence called his wife around 9:30 p.m. to let her know that he would be home later, possibly around 11. David arrived home a little later than that, probably around 11:15, but what he found was extremely horrible and terrifying once he opened the door. Again, if you're a bit queasy like I am and have a hard time with graphic content, you may want to skip ahead a few minutes or just turn around completely. Upon entering the home, David turned on the lights of the living room and saw his wife, Sarah Lawrence, lying near the family couch and the coffee table. He couldn't see her whole body, he could just see her face, but he noticed that she had blood on her face and that she was laying face up and she wasn't moving. He quickly moved around the couch to his wife, thinking that she needed assistance, and he saw the true extent of her injuries. Sarah was lying in a large pool of her own blood. She wasn't moving, and it looked like she had been stabbed several times. Sarah's body was covered in stab and slash wounds from what David suspected to be a knife, most likely. Worst yet, her throat had been cut, and blood was still flowing from the wound.
So this must have just happened moments earlier.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the detectives later on who works this case thinks that David's arrival home might have scared off the attacker.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's awful.
David also noticed Sarah was naked from the waist down. Her legs were spread and her underwear were bunched up around her right ankle. At this point, David becomes hysterical and sort of frantic. And he runs to the phone. He makes a 911 call to Amarillo Police. Afterwards, he runs to check on their three children who were then 3, 5, and 9.
The children were in the house?
They're in the house, but luckily they were all safely asleep in another room. They had slept through the entire thing.
Wow.
Sarah was only 30 years old at the time of her death. By all accounts, she was a loving mother, a wonderful wife. She was born in Kansas City, Missouri, but she moved to Amarillo in 1953. She worked as a data clerk for a company called Corporate Systems there in Amarillo. Authorities arrived shortly after, around 11:20 p.m. Sarah was pronounced dead a few minutes later. Investigators then began to examine the scene as an obvious homicide. Detectives questioned David in the master bedroom of the home. David mentioned he noticed that the screen window was popped out of place and that there were red stains on the windowsill that looked like blood. This is in the room that he's being questioned in.
Okay. So they're clearly not closing down the crime scene.
No. David also told investigators that a large Bowie knife was missing from its stand there in the master bedroom on a little shelf. He also pointed out that Sarah's purse was not in the house. Carolyn Porter, an officer in the Amarillo Police Department, took several pictures at the crime scene. She photographed what appeared to be a bloody palm print on the inside of Sarah's left leg, and she also lifted a palm print from the coffee table next to Sarah's body. Police officers Gary Chadwick and Everett Smith were kind of casing the exterior of the home when they found freshly made footprints outside of the home leading away from the Lawrence's residence. These footprints led down a back alley of sorts behind their home. The prints also continued for some 2 blocks until they terminated at another residence.
Wait, were they footprints in, like, mud?
Dirt. It's in like dirt. A okay. Dirt alleyway behind the house.
Okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no measurements were taken of these prints. They did photograph them, but they did not measure them. Why? We honestly don't really have a good answer or a good idea, except for gross negligence on the part of the investigators.
And I'm assuming they didn't put a scale in with their photograph, which
exactly. is... Exactly. That's kind of rule number one, right?
Yeah. Yes.
This is also, you know, going to be one of the points of contention by Amarillo residents when it comes to claims and, you know, their view of the police doing sloppy or shoddy police work. Now, the house where these footprints led investigators to was not just any home. It was the home of one J. Kelly Pinkerton. Police were familiar with Pinkerton as a 17-year-old high school dropout, a butcher's apprentice, and an experienced burglar. He had been charged with burglary earlier that year, but he was released due to insufficient evidence. Investigators did doubt, though, that a 17-year-old with a few petty thefts under his belt and no convictions could be their suspect. But detectives thought, well, they could find Pinkerton at home and they could question him regarding his whereabouts that night. Pinkerton wasn't home, though.
He wasn't home when they went to question him?
Yeah, they went right up to the house and knocked on his door, and he wasn't there in the middle of the night. So, 3.5 hours later, Pinkerton was spotted in a local bookstore parking lot with only jeans and tennis shoes on. No shirt. An officer chased him on foot for a few blocks before actually capturing him and detaining him. The officer noted on his report that Pinkerton was, quote, soaking wet like he just got out of the shower. Detectives questioned Pinkerton, and he appeared to cooperate. They also noticed that his sneakers had a similar dimple pattern to the prints found in the alleyway. Pinkerton's shoes were photographed, but again, not measured, and they didn't record a size.
Did they not keep the sneakers as evidence?
They did not. And now it's never been officially shared as to why this is the case, but Pinkerton was then released due to, quote, lack of evidence.
Okay. Well, did they ask him where he had been earlier that night?
Yeah. He gave an alibi and a story that he had been hanging out with friends and partying because, you know, it's October 26th. It's getting close to Halloween. He said that's why he didn't have a shirt on, that he was wearing a costume earlier, and he took it off.
Okay, well, I mean, truly, it's not like they have anything to arrest him on, but...
There's some red flags popping up, though.
I mean, were they going to continue looking at him, double-check his alibi, talk to these friends he was supposedly with?
To the public, when the media found out that somebody had been questioned, they started asking, well, who and why has he been released? And that's basically what they told him. There was a lack of evidence, and he's not a major suspect. And that they were going to continue the investigation, but that Pinkerton was not in their radar or in their crosshairs. All of this pretty much shocks the community. There were some people who trusted that Pinkerton was innocent and he was not involved, while there were others that thought that Pinkerton had gotten away with murder. Dr. Jose Diaz Esquivel examined Sarah's body at the scene, and he also later performed the autopsy. During the autopsy, the doctor determined Sarah had suffered 30 stab wounds. Most were to her arms, shoulder, neck, back, left hand, face, and abdomen.
So she was clearly standing. If he was able to stab her both from the front and from the back in all of those different ways, so it sounds like there was some kind of really major struggle, perhaps throughout the house.
Yeah.
And ended there in the living room.
Right. And it's really hard to tell because of the state of the crime scene and also how the investigation went. And we're going to talk about that too. But many of those cuts that were along her left arm and her left hand looked like they were defensive in nature.
Mm-hmm.
It was also clear that the cause of death was the wound that transected Sarah's hyoid bone and her larynx. That's pretty much an ender, right? So the doctor concluded that all of these wounds were consistent with wounds that could be caused by a large knife, such as the missing Bowie knife. So once this autopsy report becomes public knowledge, and the mention of a Bowie knife is in the report, that's when we get the name the Texas Bowie Knife Killer, and the media starts running with that. The strangest part of Sarah's wounds was the one to her abdomen. It was a large puncture wound. Dr. Diaz Esquivel determined a cylindrical object had penetrated the wound. In his final report, he stated, quote, that the introduction of a male penis into the wound would be compatible and consistent with the evidence found. Now, I don't know how that works scientifically, and my immediate thought was there was semen inside of her body cavity. But I read the medical report, and I also read his testimony in court, and I saw no mention of semen. So I don't know how he's able to tell that, but that's what he reported.
Okay. Is that something that we get confirmation of later?
Yes.
Okay. But at this point, even this early on in the investigation, he had an inkling that this vile thing happened to this poor woman.
Yes.
And he thinks that it was after death or post-mortem. At death. Postmortem. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, because that's exactly what I was going to say is, well, they must have found sperm in the wound then. But if they didn't, then I don't know how you would make that analysis.
Yeah, I don't know if back in 1979, could you test for semen if it was inside of a body cavity? Or could you just visually see it and be like, well, I think that's semen.
I mean, you could test for semen
pretty early on.
Okay. So I'm sure they could do that. I mean,
okay.
Because remember in the Texas Phantom Killer episodes that we did, this was back in the 40s, and they were actually able to test for semen.
Oh, that's right.
On and in those bodies. So in the 70s, they definitely would have the capacity to do that. And you'd think that if they found it, that would be specifically something that would be listed within the autopsy reports.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's some way that the blood congealed or wasn't the lack of blood flow after her throat had been slit, but there was still a puncture cavity in there that some object had gone in that he assumed was a penis. Like, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's awful.
Yeah.
Awful. No matter what it was.
Well, the doctor was also able to determine within a degree of certainty that Sarah had been penetrated vaginally post-mortem. Those of you who have skipped forward, we are past the worst of it. So let's continue on. No future suspects in the murder of Sarah Lawrence would become public in the following weeks. And the terror level of the citizens of Amarillo would escalate and escalate to a breaking point. It's said in Paul Carson's book that handgun sales reached an all-time high that year. And in one of his statements, police department spokesman Marvin Richardson said, quote, "Never in all my years on the force have I seen one murder cause such a stir among the people of the city and the news media." The mayor and chief of police called a news conference, and during that they told everyone that they would be doing their best to find the killer, but that all the Halloween festivities would be canceled due to safety concerns.
That seems pretty unusual to me. I mean, obviously this is a grisly, horrendous murder, but it's a pretty large town. You said around 150,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised that there would be this big of an explosion of panic in a city that size over a single murder.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people were coming forward, parents and stuff, with concerns about their kids going out trick-or-treating with such a monster on the loose. And I think that terror reached like kind of a pandemonium and mass paranoia. And again, Mayor Hodge and Chief Spradlin are just trying to keep a handle on things and do their best to calm the city down. Over the following months, no arrests came. More and more complaints began to be lobbied at Mayor Hodge and Chief Spradlin for not capturing Sarah Lawrence's killer. Then the worst thing possible happened. On April 9th, 1980, the killer struck again. This time, the victim was Sherry Welch. She was a 26-year-old former beauty queen, happily married, and managed a local furniture store in Amarillo. The killer broke into the furniture store during the early evening. Sherry was finishing up closing the store and waiting for her husband to show up to pick her up and take her home. The killer surprised her in the back room of the store, and the evidence at the crime scene suggested he forcibly raped her and violently stabbed her to death. Again, the killer did so in an extremely brutal fashion, stabbing Sherry approximately 30 times. The killer then made off into the night with some cash that he stole from the back office. Though Sherry Welch's body was not mutilated post-mortem, the other similarities surrounding the two women's death were striking. Both women were raped, stabbed a similar number of times with a large bladed weapon, possibly the same Bowie knife, and then robbed. Both victims had similar heights and build, around 5'6" and 160 pounds. They were both considered to be very attractive. However, a new clue in the Sherry Welch case was discovered by investigators once an autopsy was performed. The killer left a set of teeth marks that were visible due to a bite wound on one of Sherry's breasts. Other than that, though, no new evidence put investigators any closer to catching the Amarillo slasher.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner.
Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
One detective suggested the killer was evolving his methods, and the reason no prints were found at the scene was because he added gloves to his MO, perhaps. He also went on to say that he was probably most likely a very experienced burglar.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely seeing the parallels between the two cases, especially the violence, the brutality. Was Sherry, so she wasn't mutilated post-mortem?
No.
And she wasn't raped after her death?
Correct. They believe that she was raped before killed.
Okay. But there are still obviously parallels in the level of brutality, the number of knife wounds, the similarity, I'm assuming, in the knife wounds that look mm-hmm. like it could be this a similar weapon.
Correct.
But there are also those differences, like I just previously mentioned. It almost seems like a step down in brutality because there wasn't the mutilation of the corpse.
It seems more organized.
I would agree with that. But I was also going to say the setting is much different. So mm-hmm. you had the home setting in the first murder, and then this is a furniture store in the second murder. And I wonder if maybe he wasn't as comfortable in the furniture store. Maybe there were more people around, and so he didn't feel like he could do all of those things that he felt comfortable doing in the first murder.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. Just an idea, you know, if these murders are tied together, one would expect an escalation in violence, not sort of a de-escalation. And that's almost what you're seeing there, you know, in my opinion, not
sure
knowing too much about the case.
Well, just keep all that in mind, because we're going to talk about all that at the end.
Yeah. Okay.
Speaking of prints, though, we talked about how there were no prints at the second crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was wearing gloves. Maybe he wasn't. But remember those palm prints that I talked about earlier that were recovered?
Yeah, on the coffee table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And remember how, like, I haven't mentioned that anything's happened with them?
That's surprising.
Yeah, because nothing had happened with them.
Was there a database at that point in time?
Not for palm prints.
Okay.
Because these were, the fingerprints were too latent to get a good fingerprint on, but they had a palm print.
Okay. Would it have been a situation where they would have to, like, manually compare palm prints? Do they even take palm prints of
I don't think they did
criminals?
It this time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of makes sense then, unless you have a suspect to compare a palm print to.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
One that you maybe had in custody to begin with?
Yeah, mayhaps.
Yeah. Well, the APD forensics technicians were finally tasked 6 months later, after Sherry Welch's murder, to look at those handprints. And they compared the bloody handprints, the one left on the inner thigh of Sarah Lawrence, to the one that was latently pulled off of the coffee table. However, no definitive match could be made by the APD technicians.
Okay.
Cue the entrance of Peter Bellicastro.
Another, that's a good name.
Another great name
yeah.
in true crime. He is a fingerprint expert with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He compared the photographs of the palm print on Sarah's leg that were taken at very close up with the print that was lifted from the coffee table, and was able to determine not only that they were a match, but that the latent print on the coffee table was also made in blood, most likely from when the attacker used the coffee table to stand up. Detectives also re-examined those photos of the tennis shoe prints in the alley and the photos of Pinkerton's tennis shoes that he was wearing on the day that he was questioned. Remember, that was 3.5 hours after the murder. They were determined to be the same shoe type. Now, again, they didn't take any measurements from the alleyway prints or of his actual shoes, but they were able to tell they were the same brand and type. They even figured out what kind of sole they were.
Okay.
Detectives believed these two pieces of evidence were enough to bring Pinkerton in for a second time. But this time, they were going to throw the book at him with some formal charges of capital murder.
How did they get to that?
Well, I'm going to get to that. But on September 26, 1980, Pinkerton's arrest was broadcast all over local television. He was actually read his Miranda rights in front of City Hall on TV. which is pretty weird, right? The APD even championed it as, quote, the end of the Amarillo slasher killings. It wasn't as much of a slam dunk as the APD was making it out to be, though. Truly, it was a wild gamble, since most of the evidence they had on Pinkerton was circumstantial. You got a couple of handprints that you haven't tested, and you got a shoe type.
Well, why wouldn't they just take his palm print and compare it to the prints at the scene before they make this huge public announcement?
That was the gamble they went with.
What if they were wrong?
I know. How horrible would that have been, right?
That does not help their case.
Well, luckily for them, their secret card up their sleeve was the FBI fingerprint expert, Bella Castro. Once Pinkerton was brought in on formal charges and processed, detectives could get that oh-so-important palm print that they needed to compare to the two other prints found on Sarah Lawrence and her coffee table. Pinkerton supplied a full hand print during his processing, and after examining all three prints, Agent Bella Castro determined they were made by the same person, J. Kelly Pinkerton. So luckily for them, the gamble worked.
Yeah, that's just a lot of eggs to put in one basket.
Right? We're going to see. It's not a really well-run team of folks over there.
Yeah, it seems a little yakety sacks.
Yeah, a hot dog squad going on over there.
Yeah, for sure.
The APD and the leaders of City Hall viewed the arrest of Pinkerton as a huge success and perhaps as a sign that the citywide tensions were subsiding. Unfortunately for them, though, this wasn't the case, thanks to an article published by the Amarillo Daily News the following month. This article revealed the shoddy police work in both the Lawrence and Welch cases. The APD was directly criticized in this article for their carelessness when handling evidence, and that's because an interview with the then district attorney revealed that one of the detectives at the Lawrence crime scene picked up an item thought to have fingerprints on it from the killer with his bare hands, thus rendering it useless.
Well, you shouldn't do that.
Especially if you're a detective. Like, if you're a beat cop, like, I could get it, you know?
Yeah, you should know better, for sure. But also, how exactly does it render it? I mean, did he, like, destroy the fingerprints mm-hmm. that were... Oh, okay, yep. So he destroyed... Okay.
They had already been dusted, and he picked it up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking he just added his fingerprints to something, which is not ideal either, but, you know, you could still... If you actively destroy fingerprints touching something, then, yeah, that's a really big problem. So they actually had J. Kelly Pinkerton's fingerprints, which they could have connected to him, but they were destroyed by one of the detectives at the scene.
Yep.
Wow.
Also, you want to hear another kerfuffle?
Oh, God.
Much of the crime scene had been contaminated by police foot traffic in and around the body of Sarah Lawrence. So they didn't really put together until David had explained to them that the window had been popped out and that's how the killer probably gained entry and that's probably how he left. They couldn't figure out where he had come from because of all the footprints that were in and around the body. They were tracking blood, like, all over the living room.
How?
Because they're not doing very good work. And that's what this article is really kind of pointing a finger at. This is without mentioning having Pinkerton in custody from the beginning, not measuring his shoes or the footprints.
And not taking his palm prints.
Yep, that's true. Not taking his palm prints during that initial questioning. So you can see that the mountain of negligence is starting to pile up.
Yeah, for sure. How did this journalist find out all this information? Do you know?
I think that they had been a longtime friend of the district attorney.
Oh, and the district attorney.
Yeah, he was the one that did the interview.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so there's like some people that are on the inside of City Hall that are kind of fed up with the way things are going.
Kind of like whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah.
Make your police force better. Right?
That's right.
And that's one way to do it, is to point out to the public, these are all of the horrible things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the final thing I'll say about this article that came out from the Amarillo Daily News is that they pretty clearly showed that Pinkerton was the major suspect from the beginning of the case to the end, and that they never really had the evidence that they needed, and they didn't perform the investigation the way they should have to make the arrest early on and stop Sherry Welch's unfortunate murder.
Yeah, so they told the public and the media that they released him, that he wasn't a major suspect, but he was.
Yeah, they basically were lying to cover their tracks.
Did this writer speculate as to why they would have done something like that?
Their speculation was that they weren't doing a good job. investigating the case, and they were trying to stop fear in the public, and they were also trying to still build a case against Pinkerton to eventually bring him in and arrest him.
I also wondered if it might have something to do with the fact that he was underage.
Now, it's interesting you bring that up, because he was of age, because at that time, being 17, you could be tried as an adult.
So you were considered an adult in the eyes of the law at 17?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, but I guess that didn't have anything to do with it then.
Well, I thought the same thing, and I thought that might have something to do with it, but I'll explain that here in a little bit.
Okay.
So a grand jury hearing was scheduled to investigate the gross negligence of Chief Spradlin and the whole of the Amarillo Police Department. Paul Carlson points out in his book that Mayor Hodge, who had been firmly supporting Chief Spradlin, was forced to backpedal and deliver a damning statement to the leering press.
Oh, of course.
Quote, "The failure to arrest Pinkerton in the Lawrence case had in fact led to the needless death of Sherry Welch." Furthermore, Hodge expressed that the recent reports of negligence and corruption in the Amarillo Daily News had forced him to lose respect for Spradlin and the entire APD. He now fully supported the grand jury investigative hearings and hoped that their resolution would bring a more studious and fact-based law system for the city of Amarillo. Well, good lip service.
Yeah, it just seems kind of like when finally all this news breaks. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying.
None of us really do, but he's being a politician, it sounds like.
Yeah. As soon as these things become known publicly, then all of a sudden you have to, yeah.
Well, and I think it's, you know, this is something that the African-American community was pointing out earlier on after several botched cases in the northern part of Amarillo in the predominantly black neighborhoods. They had really been championing these arguments, and one of their points that they bring up is, oh, now that white women are dying, you care.
Yeah.
And I think they have a valid point. So let's talk about the trials. Even though various leadership and City Hall were now firmly on hot seats, so to speak, the planning of Pinkerton's trial for both the murders of Sarah Lawrence and Sherry Welch had to move forward. On April of 1981, Pinkerton's trial for rape and murder of Sarah Lawrence was moved to Corpus Christi, approximately 660 miles away due to the tense atmosphere in Amarillo at the time.
Yeah, that's a really far change of venue.
You went from one of the most northern towns in Texas to arguably one of the most southern.
Yeah.
Reportedly, Pinkerton appeared to enjoy this time in the limelight, even autographing items such as candy wrappers and napkins and handing them out to people.
What?
Yeah.
Who was looking for his autograph?
Lots of people. It was really kind of sick.
That's insanity.
Yeah. And he also took as many opportunities as he could to speak with the media and profess his innocence.
I'm excited because I'm assuming it's going to be brought up in trial about the palm print. I'm wondering how he's going to explain that away.
So the prosecution laid out their case. They brought forward their palm printing FBI expert. They brought forward the medical examiner, crime scene technicians, all their shoe evidence, which, as shoddy as it was still evidence that they could bring forward, and they requested the death penalty. And again, even though he was 17, he was being tried as an adult, so he was eligible for capital punishment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
His lawyer really didn't have any defense for any of the forensics.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One thing that was surprising was when the prosecution called their star witness, which was John Alley. He was a fellow inmate with Pinkerton in the Randall County Jail. Alley testified that over the course of 6 months, Pinkerton would not stop talking about the murder of Sarah Lawrence. Alley went over all the gory, brutal details that Pinkerton shared with him. During this back and forth with the prosecutor and John Alley, one of the important things that he said was when he was asked the question, did he sexually assault her? And he said, yes, sir. And then he asked him, is that what he said in those words? And John Alley responded with, well, I don't really want to get into it. When pressured further by the prosecutor, he replied with, he cut her stomach open, he effed her in the wound until he came. And then he slashed her throat, end quote.
Oh, God, that's horrible. Question, though, because I thought that the medical examiner had found that that wound was postmortem.
Yeah, it doesn't really line up with the timeline. But then again, the prosecution is able to argue that away as, well, this is just him bragging and embellishing, you know, okay. his own personal timeline and kind of being a braggadocio dude about it in prison.
And was this common knowledge at the time? Like, was this...
No, it wasn't in the media.
It wasn't in the media at all. Okay. So it seems like it was definitely something that he had been told by Pinkerton.
Yes.
Okay. Ugh, that is so awful.
And because these claims by John Alley so closely match what forensic technicians and investigators saw from the evidence at the scene, that's why it was included in the trial. It really goes to help corroborate the medical examiner's report.
Yeah, it does.
The one thing that John Alley talks about in his testimony that he claimed Pinkerton said that doesn't really match up is he claimed that Pinkerton further mutilated Lawrence's body by cutting off her breasts before he left. Now, this troubled me, obviously, for general reasons, because it's horrific, but I couldn't find any evidence of that. And that just seems like he's telling a tall tale. And if he did actually tell John Alley that, it was a lie, because I can't find anywhere where that was the case in the medical examiner's report or the crime scene report. Nothing.
That's what it seems like. And that might have been a part of his fantasies.
Maybe.
Because remember with Sherry Welch, how he bit her breast.
Oh, yeah.
So that might have been, again, you know, attacking the genitalia, breasts of a female victim is something that's pretty common in sexually sadistic attacks. So it wouldn't be surprising if that was a part of his fantasy. And that's something that he was telling people, again, like you were saying, to kind of brag about all of these horrendous things he did. Mm-hmm. And he's actually upping the ante even beyond what he actually did.
Yeah. And, you know, if you had any questions about why John Alley was saying this, he didn't get any less time for testifying. He volunteered to testify, and when asked by the prosecutors why he chose to testify against Pinkerton, Alley had said this in response, quote, "I have a little 3-year-old girl and a pretty little wife at home, and I'll be damned if I'm going to sit there and see somebody like that go free after he bragged for 6 months that he'd done it and it might be my wife or my daughter next time." So there you go.
Well, good for him.
Well, on May 30th of 1981, the jury provided a swift verdict of guilty. And Pinkerton was sentenced to death for the murder, rape, burglary, and post-mortem mutilation of Sarah Lawrence. He became the youngest person sentenced to death in Texas since the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. The following year, in April of 1982, Pinkerton faced a second trial for the rape and murder of Sherry Welch. This time, the trial was moved to El Paso. They're kind of circumnavigating the state with these two trials.
Yeah.
Well, again, Pinkerton appeared to relish his time in the spotlight and play to the media. And although the prosecution could not rely on palm prints or tennis shoe imprints this time around, they did have a different key piece of evidence to use. What do you think that was, Aaron?
Oh, the bite mark on her breast.
Mm-hmm. The prosecution was able to take a dental impression from Pinkerton in jail, and with the assistance of a dentist, they matched those impressions to the bite mark found on Sherry Welch's body.
That's interesting, because I know that bite mark impressions have more recently been questioned as to their accuracy.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so too, because I've heard the same thing.
Yeah.
And this was kind of their smoking gun in this case.
I'm sure.
You know, and however you feel about dental impressions and their validity, I mean, I don't know if he had a wonky tooth that really stood out and, you know, like made it obvious that it was him. But this was all the jury needed because, again, they brought back a swift verdict. Pinkerton celebrated the anniversary of his first murder trial with another conviction, drawing his second death sentence on May 13th, 1982. Pinkerton spent the rest of his time in prison, filing 3 different appeals. He continued to claim his innocence in both murder cases and compelled any wrongful conviction lawyer to look at his case. He actually learned some law while he was in prison and wrote up his own appeals drafts, and he was actually awarded 3 separate stays of execution on his own writing for appeals.
Wow. So this kid was actually fairly smart.
Yeah, he was pretty intelligent, even though he was a high school dropout.
Yeah.
And
a vile murderer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're not trying to, like, give him praises or anything. It's just some criminals are smart and some aren't.
Well, it's also just what a waste. Yeah. Obviously for the women that he killed and their families and all of the people he affected, but also the fact that he was 17 years old and obviously a smart kid and could have actually done things with his life. Yeah. But this is what he chose to do.
Well, each time Pinkerton's attorney asked the court to block his execution on grounds of improper use of a surprise witness, being John Alley, and ineffective legal assistance. The last appeal resulted in a stay of execution within a half hour before Pinkerton was set to be strapped to the injection chair. And that means that witnesses were already in the chamber.
Oh, wow. Like the families mm-hmm. of the victims?
And they got told they had to come back later. Yeah, a federal appeals court a few hours later rejected Pinkerton's bid for a fourth stay. And on May 15th, 1986, he was set to be executed. While in prison, Pinkerton said he made peace with his coming death by converting to Islam in recent years. In an article to the Associated Press, Texas Department of Corrections spokesman Charles Brown said, quote, "He stayed up almost all night working on legal papers for another possible stay. After a final meal of crackers, fish patties, tartar sauce, French fries, sliced onions, and coffee."
Oh my God, that is disgusting.
Yeah. Pinkerton spent the rest of the evening playing dominoes with the prison chaplain. His final statement was directed at his father, Gene, who was in attendance, and God. Quote, "Be strong for me, Dad. I want you to know I'm at peace with myself and with God." He then recited a prayer, quote, "I bear witness that there is no God but Allah. With your praise, I ask for forgiveness, and I return unto you. I love you, Dad." And with that, J. Kelly Pinkerton was injected, and he was pronounced dead at 12:25 a.m. He was 24 when he died. Well, the fallout of this case was that Chief Spradlin was removed from his position with the Amarillo Police Department, and Mayor Hodge resigned soon after, citing, quote, "pressures of the office." I think it's also worth mentioning that the grand jury investigations into the Amarillo Police Department resulted in the eventual creation of a new unit known as the Potter Randall Special Crimes Unit. More specifically, this would become Amarillo's first ever highly skilled crime scene unit.
Oh, interesting.
So these two women, hopefully, you know, with the creation of this new technological and very highly skilled crime scene unit, this will stop something like this from ever happening again.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. People get angry about people criticizing police departments and police work. But guess what? When you are able to point out problems and flaws within those departments, they can get corrected, which is better for everybody. It's better for the community. It's better for victims and the families. And it's better for the police officers themselves and detectives and all of that. It's better for everyone.
It holds everyone to a higher standard.
Exactly, which is what you want.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the last thing I wanted to say about this particular case was it was really hard to find pictures of the victims because a lot of the papers that covered this case back in the 80s have all been archived and no longer exist. And so a lot of those newspapers have been transcribed into transcribed records, but the photos that went along with those articles don't exist anymore. And if they do, they're probably on like microfilm in the library at Amarillo, and I didn't have time to drive out there, so sorry.
It's quite a few hours away, for sure. So, yeah. And I know that you also did as much checking online as possible, and they're just not available anywhere.
They just don't exist. Yeah. I've tried really hard. And I found a couple of pictures that I thought might be them, but I couldn't say definitively that it was, so I didn't feel comfortable putting it out there.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about J. Kelly Pinkerton and his place in this kind of pantheon of Texas true crime history. What kind of killer do you think he was? I mean, do you think he was either de-escalating because he couldn't perform the things that he ideally wanted to do? Or do you think that he was evolving as a killer from a disorganized killer to a more organized killer? So like some of the key things about being disorganized match the first crime scene a lot. So he lived nearby. He didn't have to go very far.
He probably knew her, at least saw her around the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Typically, a disorganized killer will have sex with a body after they're dead. He found his weapon of choice at the scene.
Mm-hmm.
There was torture. He cut her up a lot before he actually killed her. He got there by walking, which is another typical thing by disorganized killers.
And he didn't seem to have a plan for the aftermath.
Right.
So he, I guess, got rid of the shirt he was wearing, but he went somewhere to wash up, but he was still wearing the same shoes, maybe the same pants even. When he was found, he didn't really have a good alibi. It wasn't exactly planned, which is, again, the mark of somebody who is a disorganized serial killer.
Now let's look at Sherry Welch's case. The body was kind of locked away, hidden in a back room. It wasn't just in the middle of a living room where he knew someone was going to come home and find it. He raped her before he killed her, which does fall into the category of organized. He brought his weapon with him. From what investigators could tell, it was a quick struggle, and the act didn't take nearly as long as Sarah Lawrence's case. It looked sophisticated. He most likely wore gloves. And some people think that he was paying attention to the news articles that were coming out. It had been published that they had a palm print, so that might be another reason why he might have worn gloves.
Sure, yeah.
It's suspected that he drove a car to get to the furniture store. And, you know, this crime happened further away from home. He had to travel to the specific location, case it out probably, plan beforehand. It wasn't just a deep compelling or a rush that came over him to compel him to do this. There was some thought. It was premeditated. So what do you think? I mean, I think all those kind of fit into the category. And we know he's highly intelligent and that he has at least some aptitude to write legal documents.
I mean, some of those things can kind of go either way.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as the necrophiliac aspect of it, if that's your thing, then you could do that no matter what, if you're a organized or disorganized serial killer, for example. If Sarah was his first attack, his first murder, which may or may not be the case, he might have raped before this. That's a lot of times what happens. So you're seeing somebody who's really excited, who is a little bit sloppy maybe in the way he's killed her, and then by the second one he's done it better. His heart isn't pounding as quickly. He knows what he's doing a little bit better. And so you're seeing somebody who I think has learned from attack number one versus attack number two.
Well, and he also almost got caught the first time.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's wised up a little bit. He's calmed down. He had all of those months fantasize about what he had done and what he wanted to do next time.
Yep.
And that's all very similar to what you see with a sort of budding serial killer as mm-hmm. they're starting out. And I mean, what's really horrific about the whole thing is his age.
17, yeah.
Because I mean, obviously the burglarizing, very typical, usually some sort of sexual activity, sexual assault or peeping Tom, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. That's really typical for serial killers when they're teenagers, when they're first starting out. But to go all the way to, you know, what he did at 17 is...
Some people think that he was already being a peeping Tom on Sarah from the alleyway because he did remember gaining access through the master window.
I would not be surprised. In fact, I would almost bet that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's really chilling to think that a 17-year-old could
be a serial killer.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. So you're on the side of he's a serial killer, or at least a budding serial killer, because the old definition used to require 3 or more deaths.
Yes. And so I'm old school because I like the 3 or more deaths situation, mm-hmm. but I can go with 2. I mean,
well, now we find ourselves in this case where we only have 2 murders.
Well, you know what? If you extrapolate the fact out, I mean, if he hadn't been caught, he would have killed again.
Yeah,
absolutely. There's no doubt about that. So it's just we prevented that from happening. Thank God.
Well, the new definition that has come out recently from the National Institute of Justice, I believe it was just last year, their new definition is a serial killer is, quote, committing 2 or more murders with psychological motive and sadistic sexual overtones. On this conception, serial killing can be understood as a type of sex crime, a monstrous version of normal male sexuality. Now, a lot of people have brought up complaints about this new definition.
Okay.
One of the main cons is that the definition seems to be completely entrenched and slanted towards male serial killers, because it specifically says the version of normal male sexuality in the definition. Female serial killers often are not motivated by sexual gratification. And when you look at the numbers statistically of female serial killers, sex typically doesn't have anything to do with it. Sometimes it does, but more often than not, it doesn't.
True.
Another complaint that they have is that this definition also does not account for what some argue are fear and power-driven killers, like the Iceman, Richard Kuklinski. He killed and was devoid of any sexual elements to his killings. he killed for power.
That we know of.
Well, that we know of, but a lot of people have argued that Richard Kuklinski should be listed as a serial killer because he killed for power and for fear. Also, the last thing that people are really having an issue with this definition is it's problematic for killers that are driven by mental illness, psychosis, or other things such as like schizophrenia or severe delusions of reality, such as Richard Chase, the Vampire of Sacramento. Still a serial killer, but not sexually driven. So PhD Barrett Brogard, remember that source that I told you about at the beginning of the episode?
Uh-huh.
I'm getting to it right here, right now. She put out this article that's really interesting talking about alternative ways to view serial killers as we move forward and learn more about how serial killers work and how there's just so many different types of serial killers. So what she talks about is compartmental theory or prototype theory of viewing serial killers, and it's really kind of gaining some ground among other forensic psychologists in more recent years. And the way that she kind of talks about it, and I think is a really simple way to view it, is when you go to, like, let's say Target, right? And you go to the home goods section. Home goods is huge, but there's a couch section. There's a bathroom section. There's a lamp section. Well, let's say Ted Bundy and the sexually driven killers are in the lamp section. And let's say Richard Chase is in the couch section. They're all still home goods. It's just they're compartmentalized and they're prototyped. So when you start talking about prototype theory, you start talking about looking at serial killers in true crime and in history and comparing new killers to them and saying, do they fit compartmentally to the prototype of that compartment? Does that make sense?
No, that makes sense. And I think that to some degree that's happened for a long time. I mean, like you even said, comparisons between organized and disorganized serial killers, that's been around for decades, as far as I know. So there have been ways people have tried to assign or categorize serial killers for a while. So this is a sort of a more systematic classification system that she's kind of referring to or proposing.
And the reason I bring all this back up is if you want to look at J. Kelly Pinkerton as a serial killer, you have to find a prototype to compare him to. So that's what I tried to do in my own research.
Oh,
so,
okay. Interesting. Yeah.
So my first thought was possible other young serial killers. Even though J. Kelly Pinkerton wasn't a minor in Texas, he could have been a minor other places. So I was looking at like really young serial killers. My first thought was Mary Bell. You know, she killed a couple of young boys. They were 3 and 4 and they were like 4 months apart and she was 11 years old. But I was like, man, that's not a very good fit. And so my next one that I found was Craig Price, and he's the Warwick slasher. And I think he's a really good fit, but he killed between when he was 13 and 15 years old. And he killed 4 people in his neighborhood and one that was a little further away from his neighborhood. And he killed 2 women and 2 children, but he also had a history of petty theft, of burglary, of being a peeping Tom, and he killed his victims with vicious amounts of stabbings. And also, he was reportedly sexually motivated. The only real difference in his case was that he would typically get high on marijuana and LSD before he went and did his murdering. But yeah, I think as far as I could find in my limited research, I think Craig Price is a good prototype for this young, sexually motivated stabbing slasher killer.
Well, I mean, there have been a lot of other serial killers who started out fairly young in their attacks or their murders, just didn't get caught until much later. I mean, Ted Bundy, a lot of people think that he first killed when he was a teenager. There was a little girl who lived in his neighborhood who went missing. I don't know if she was ever found or if she was found, but her case was never solved. And Ted Bundy, as a teenager, knew her. I think he maybe babysat her, or maybe they just knew each other from being in the same neighborhood. And people think that it's possible that she was his first victim.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's very possible as well. And so that's very similar to, you know, this kind of type of thing where you choose your first victim based on somebody that you know, somebody you have some kind of relationship with, or you've fetishized in your mind or whatever, and they're easily available, and that's who you go for.
That makes sense. I just thought that since Craig Price had been caught when he was 15, it was also another like kind of close fit.
Yeah.
But the last interesting thing about Craig Price that I wanted to bring up was he got a much more minor sentence because he was a juvenile.
Uh-huh.
He got a 10 to 25 year sentence, and he could get out on early behavior as soon as this year.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so when you talk about adulthood and what can you charge someone who's 17 years old with around the country, in a lot of places you have to be 18 to be charged with capital murder or first degree murder.
Yeah.
Well, for a long time, I think since like 1918, Texas has allowed 17-year-olds to be charged with capital murder up until last year. And that's when the age of criminal responsibility in Texas rose from 17 to 18 under a new bill from House lawmakers. And it was House Bill 122, known as the Raise the Age Bill. It removed 17-year-old offenders from the adult criminal justice system to its juvenile justice system counterpart beginning in 2021. So it kind of gives some time for jails and prisons and lawmakers and prosecutors to catch up and adjust. And
yeah.
Then in 2021, we're no longer going to charge 17-year-olds with capital murder. That's interesting because if J. Kelly Pinkerton had been caught in 2021, he would be treated like Craig Price.
Exactly. And he'd be out someday.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a really interesting conundrum as sort of like a social thought experiment, you know?
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, absolutely not should a 17-year-old be charged with capital murder. That's insane. In fact, I would almost kind of think that I would like to raise it even higher. We know that the brain is not fully as organized or developed.
Especially in males.
Yeah, until oftentimes the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're holding children responsible for actions that they may not really have full responsibility for biologically.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue for sure. But like you said, at the same time, what happens with those few cases where we're catching a serial killer before they can really set out to do the most damage?
Yeah, this is what John Douglas and, you know, the people who are involved with the real life mind hunters in the FBI, yeah. This is their whole point, is to catch them as early as we can and pull them out of society. Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily advocating that they should still be, you know, charged with capital punishment, but at least, you know, like, throw them in the slammer for the rest of their lives, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to see people like that out because I'm not naive enough to think that they're going to stop. Because I know from a lot of research that there's nothing to show that a sexual predator like this can be rehabilitated.
There's absolutely no evidence. And, you know, even in J. Kelly Pinkerton's psychological evaluations that he took in prison, all of his prison psychologists said there was no hope to rehabilitate him.
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea that that one day a person like that would be out and able to do something like this again, we know that we don't have a justice system that rehabilitates prisoners either. Whether or not they can be rehabilitated again is a good question, but they don't do it anyway. So it's a really good question. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a fitting way to end this case. And I thought it was interesting to consider how Texas deals with these crimes until 2021 and our history versus Rhode Island's history with our prototype case that we're using in Craig Price. I thought that was fascinating because it's two different worlds of thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's plenty of people who say that we shouldn't have the death penalty and capital punishment is state-sponsored murder, which is, you know, completely backwards. And I totally see that as well. Our justice system is messed up. We know that. I don't have all the answers.
Yep.
I have my opinions, but even my opinions on those things aren't like super strong.
Man, with habitual sex offenders, serial sex offenders,
yeah.
You know, serial killers, I don't see what use we have for them.
And that's kind of been my thing.
Yeah.
Those people, I don't mind if they're,
mm-hmm.
if they're taken off the planet.
Yeah.
They don't operate like us. They aren't us. They will never be like us.
You can't teach
them
how
broken.
To be human.
They're, yeah. They have lizard brains. I mean, they don't.
Yeah.
Think and feel like the rest of us do.
Exactly.
And they'll never change. And that's terrifying, but it's kind of the truth.
And if they're a true sociopath or a psychopath, they can lie to you act like they've changed.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a good spot to end our story today. And that, my friends, is the story of the murders of Sarah Lawrence, Sherry Welch, and the Amarillo Slasher, aka the Texas Bowie Knife Killer.
Well, that was a really good job. I think that could have gotten really bogged down in the horrible details about those poor women and their murders. I'm glad that we were kind of able to do that, I think, as best we can. without relishing those horrible details. So you did a really good job.
No, thank you. I tried to. That was my big focus.
Yeah. Just a sad, horrible case all around.
But you can see how there's like similarities to your Moonlight Killer, the Phantom of Texarkana, with like kind of the terror that was going on in the city as these attacks were happening.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
So I thought that was kind of interesting comparison.
Thank God there was only two of them.
Mm-hmm. Instead of five.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have a really good news story that's going to end things up on a positive note. I promise you guys, it's one of my favorite good news stories I've had so far. So
yay, we need it.
We definitely need it. So after the break, come back and I'll tell you something to make you happy.
Woo!
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Our good news story today is a great one coming from Kristen Dickerson of NBC DFW News, and it is out of Keller, Texas, which is a city north of Fort Worth.
Thank you, Keller. Couldn't come at a better time.
Keller has been rated one of the best cities to live in the United States and one of the richest cities in the U.S., which are two things that are probably related.
Probably.
Well, Keller High School has a marching band, and they are considered one of the best in the country. So, Shay, you were in marching band.
I was.
And you loved it.
I loved it. It was great. I was a band nerd all the way.
Yeah, so I wasn't in band, but from everyone I know who was, I've only heard really great things, no matter where they went to high school, about teamwork and camaraderie when it comes to being in marching band. And this is a story that really commemorates that. Well, freshman Drew Bell said that he wanted to be in the marching band since as long as he can remember. But there was one problem. Drew has spina bifida. Now, there are a few different types of spina bifida, but essentially it's a birth defect that causes the vertebrae to not develop properly in a way that completely encloses and protects the spinal cord. Usually it's the sacrum or the lower part of the spine that's affected, but it can pretty much affect any part of the spine.
Oh, that sounds bad.
Yeah, so if you can imagine, depending on how open those vertebral bodies are in the back, will directly correlate with how many spinal issues you're going to have. Some people have just a little gap in the back of the vertebrae, and they may not even know that they have it. Others might have pain, back issues, and still others might have mobility problems and even paralysis. So Drew is in a wheelchair, and you know, he's a normal kid in every way. It's just that he needs a wheelchair to get around. But as I'm sure you know, there's no way you can move your wheelchair around and play an instrument at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where senior Kaylee Summons came in. She volunteered to move Drew around in his wheelchair so he could participate in the marching band.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so she was also in the marching band. This, of course, means that she basically has given up her playing herself in the marching band in order to kind of be Drew's legs and help him move around the performances.
That's a huge sacrifice for your senior year in marching band.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there was a lot of coordination that takes place on the field during performances. And so they really had to work together to get those movements right, to get everything seamless with the rest of the band. Kaylee said, quote, "It's not really a sacrifice when you like doing it. I just did it to make sure he knew that he always had a place in the band and he always will."
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. And so Kaylee, she's a senior, so she's going to be moving on next year. But they said that somebody else, they're sure, are going to come behind her and help him in the next coming years as well, so he can continue being in marching band. So it's just a really incredible story. And it does not end there. The Keller High School Marching Band has actually been invited to perform in New York City this year at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Oh, wow. That's huge.
It's huge. It's the first time that Keller High School has performed at the parade, and they're actually the only marching band from Texas that will be there this year. So if you get a chance to watch the parade, be sure to check out the Keller High School Marching Band, and you'll be able to see Drew and Kaylee performing.
That is so cool.
Yeah, very sweet story.
Yeah, it's awesome. We had someone who was in an electric wheelchair in our marching band, but they played in the pit with percussion. Yeah, so she played played xylophone and a couple of the other kind of standing instruments that are down off the field. But she really enjoyed it and she was really good at it. And I love hearing stories like that of seniors like this, you know, really sacrificing for an amazing cause to pay it forward and let somebody else experience the joy and the love of marching band.
All right, guys, welcome to the after show. Usually we have a podcast recommendation here, but this has been a very long episode and we're just going to go straight to doing our reviews. And first up is going to be our podcast Patreon friends.
Yeah, the real All Crime No Cattle official posse.
That's right.
Because it's the first podcast of November. So we gotta give those people credit for supporting our show.
That's right. But before we do that, let's drop our social media crap so you can follow it or not or do whatever you want to do.
That's right.
And you can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast and on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. And you can drop us a line at Gmail. Our Gmail account is allcrimenocattle@gmail.com.
We're also on the Facebook. You can just search All Crime No Cattle. And you can also find merch for the show at either our Patreon, which is patreon.com/allcrimenocattle, or at our Threadless shop at threadless.com/allcrimenocattle.
Yeah. Oh, and fun things happened recently on our Facebook page. We had a little competition for a little Halloween costume contest.
That's right.
And it went neck and neck. Things were nitty gritty, man.
You guys submitted so many awesome costumes. You submitted pet costumes, kids, your own costumes. It was amazing. It was so good, in fact, that we had, what, an 8-way tie?
Yes.
We had to have a runoff. And then we had people that I think were trying to stuff the ballot boxes and go get friends and family to come vote on their pictures, which, hey
it's smart to do.
We didn't say you couldn't, so that was smart. And it came down to, I think, the poodle pumpkin dog and three wiener dogs dressed up as hot dogs. And the wiener dogs came out victorious. So those stickers will be in the mail. Our Patreon rewards are in the mail. And you should be getting all those. And now we got a fresh new month. Are you ready to name off some patrons?
Let's do it.
Starting off, you know who's at the top of the list. It's our Texas Ranger, Lisa L.
What?
We love you, Lisa L.
Hey, Lisa. So I was watching the Dallas Stars game the other day, and Jamie Benn at one point looked straight into the camera, and I saw him mouth, I'm pretty sure, I love Lisa L.
Yeah.
It was very weird, but I'm just telling you, I'm not sure if you caught that, Lisa.
Just want to give you a heads up.
Yeah, for sure happened.
Then we've got our small town sheriffs, can't forget them, Ashley P., Rebecca, Heather N., next up, we got our lone guns, and that's Deborah H., Claire J., Megan L., Alyssa F., Kaya A., Jisoo K., Lauren M., Megan J., Mindy M., Karen P., Emily H., The Gone Cold Podcast, Karen B., thank you guys so much.
Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah, those lone guns that'll take on any desperado or bandito.
That's right.
And now we get to our deputized.
Hold on, I was going to do a their own sound effect for them. Okay. Ching, 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 ching. That's your...
Spurs?
That's your Spurs going.
They're headed to the OK Corral for a shootout?
Oh, that's right. That's what they're doing.
Okay. Next we have our deputies, which would be Gary D., Kelly R., Gracie B., Danielle D., The Murder and Such Podcast, Marianne C., Corpus Delecti Podcast, True Crime Fan Club Podcast, Jessica M., Donald B., Jamie B., Kate from Ignorance Was Bliss, the podcast, Erica K. from Southern Fried True Crime, Kara J., Elizabeth M., Lori S., and Scarlett P. Thank you. You guys are awesome.
That's their lassos.
Oh, their lassos.
A lasso in the bad guys. That's awesome. I didn't
know. Because they're really good farmhands and cattle rustlers that have been deputized to join a posse.
Absolutely.
So that's what they're good for. They got that lasso.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I didn't know so many of our pod friends supported us this month. How wonderful.
Isn't that great?
A great group of people.
Yeah, that's one of the best things about the true crime podcast community. Friends helping friends.
That's right. Thank you all for your support. We love you so much. We are going to be doing Patreon stuff.
Around the middle of the month.
Yeah. Middle of the month is when we're going to send everything out. The next Patreon episode towards the middle to the end.
That's right. And maybe we'll get one of those Discord Ask Me Anything Q&As going for the Lone Guns and up.
Yeah.
I think they deserve that.
That'd be fun.
All right. Well, with no further ado, we got to get to them reviews.
Let's do it. And remember, we're not going to be doing this for very much longer. In fact, we have our two final Facebook 5-star reviews read on the show, unless somebody has a really fantastic one that maybe we decide to read later. But let's go with the first one, which is Ryan Cleveland. And they say, as a true crime fanatic, this is by far in my top 5 podcasts. The stories are told very well, and the hosts do an amazing job of keeping you entertained. Thank you very much, Ryan. Very nice.
Yes, thank you.
And our final one comes from Audrey Matthews. They say, my friend suggested your podcast, and I absolutely love it. I'm already on episode 13, and I just started last week.
Oh, wow. You're quick.
The chemistry between you guys is amazing. It's like listening to two friends have a conversation. You're not interrupting or talking over each other, and the stories you tell are always very interesting. The format is better than any other podcast I've ever listened to.
Holy moly.
I will definitely be recommending your podcast to friends. Thank you so much, Audrey. Yeah, that is a very delightful review. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's weird because we're not quite conversational. We're not quite scripted. We're like a hybrid.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that people get that and appreciate it.
Yeah. Not everybody does, but you know what? Boo Earns.
Did you say Boo Earns? Alrighty, switching over to the iTunes, we've got Turtle292.
I'm already on board for Turtle.
I like turtles. They say, only bad thing about this podcast is that I caught up on all the episodes and I have to wait for the next one to come out.
That is truly a tragedy.
It is. But thank you for listening. And I'm glad that's the only bad thing for you. 14STBC says, wonderful. These two hosts switch off telling stories, one each episode. They both do amazing research and tell a great story, and the back and forth between them is perfect. Also, one of the top 3 musical intros in podcasting, in my humble opinion.
Well, your humble opinion
is great.
It's a good one. Thank you. Who is it?
14STBC.
Thank you, 14STBC.
Nano Marie says, it's official. I'm hooked. I've been binge listening since July 11th, totally caught up, and totally hooked. Keep up the good work. Hashtag Texas proud.
That's right.
Yeehaw! TC Addict 36 says, Texas for the win! Heard about this show in a promo from True Crime Fan Club, and I was reluctant to check it out, but I'm so glad I did. This has quickly been made a staple in my podcast playlist. The two hosts seem really great, and I just enjoy the show.
I'm glad you're here. Glad you checked it out. I'm glad you took the plunge.
Yeah, and I'm glad Lainey recommended us to you.
Yeah.
Lindsay MC89 says, two thumbs up. Love, love, love your podcast. I'm a Fort Worth girl myself, currently living in South Texas, south of San Antonio, to be exact. I'm new to the podcast world, but I'm so glad I stumbled upon your show. Y'all are so fun and easy to listen to. Y'all make sitting in the dreadful car pickup line not so bad. Also, I was wondering if y'all have done a show about the little girl who went missing in Saginaw in the 90s. Her name was Opal Jennings. Just a suggestion. I often wonder about her. Thank you so much for your true crime suggestion. And if anyone else has any other Texas cases they want to suggest, we're happy to hear them.
Yeah, send them over to allcrimenocattle@gmail.com.
That's right. Last one, Sarah Trice says, y'all are awesome. I love the show. I love the production and the conversational tone. It's great that it's so Texas-centric. I am married to a Texan, and as an honorary Texan, I'm enjoying hearing the cases unique to this state. It's been eye-opening and fascinating. It's a great connecting point for me and my honey, as he's very familiar with many of the areas in East Texas where some of the crimes are committed. Thanks for all the great things you're bringing to this genre. That was a really nice review.
That was very nice.
Thank you, Sarah Trice.
I'm glad to hear that we're helping you bond with your husband.
Yeah, get that bonding on. All right, well, that's it for the after show. We got to get working. We got to get cooking on the next one. So we're going to have to let you guys go. I hope you enjoyed episode 37. And, until next time, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.